Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Vicky Mazzone. This program takes a look at the politics in all that we experience in life, from observations on the current administration from a lifelong Republican, to the history of women's voting rights. Politics impact our daily lives. On today's show, contributor ML Laurie continues her thoughts about what affects our daily decisions. Denise Kowalczyk presents a compilation of voices from the 2003 protests against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Kristen Thiel highlights two women whose work helped give women the right to vote. But first, new contributor Rochelle Schmid shares a conversation with her grandmother, Louisa Thurber. Louisa is well-traveled and educated, speaks several languages, and candidly shares her thoughts concerning the state of the Republican Party.
My name is Rochelle, and I'm here with my grandmother, Louisa. I would just like to ask you some of your opinions on the Republican Party. And just to give a little bit of context, background-wise, she is an educated woman with a bachelor's degree and has traveled, in fact, lived in a few other countries, but lived most of your life in America and have been a registered Republican for most of your life.
I'm 88 years old, and at age 18, I registered as a Republican, and I'm still registered as a Republican. So what questions do you have?
Well, I wanted to get your just general thoughts and opinions on how the Republican Party has evolved and changed since you first registered versus the way it is today.
Currently, I think it's been hijacked. It used to be a party of thinking people and high standards, not that the Democrats weren't, but they were more progressive, more government help type things, and they've done some wonderful things, such as Social Security and aid to dependent children and other good things that have been needed, and women's voting rights, to just mention a few. But I think a lot of the Republicans are very well educated too, and certainly more business oriented than the Democrats. Our current leadership doesn't appear to be educated or with any particular set of standards. That bothers me. It seems as though the Republican Party is going along because it's politics. They want the vote to keep their jobs. But some of the things that are being done and the lack of morality and the lack of sense, good sense, just bothers me a great deal. I don't think if the opinions are considered, and they certainly there is a lack of morality and just thoughtfulness. And as again, I think our current president is a detriment to the country and an embarrassment to the country.
Which things would you hope the Republican Party maintains going forward?
I hope they maintain a spirit of self-reliance, because this is so important to people, for both from the material point of view, having what they need, and from the personal point of view. They need to know that they can take care of themselves. And if they find a way to do something, this is excellent. And if they look, they most often can find a way to do something. But to just give up and say, let the government do it, is not healthy for anybody. Now, I don't vote constantly Republican. I vote for the person. I vote for their values. I vote for probably more as an independent, but that doesn't mean I don't have, I'm not registered as a Republican. I am, and I support the party, but I don't support the party's values and the current leadership as it is today. I just think it's an embarrassment to the country, and I think it is going to harm the country, and sometimes I'm very, very concerned about the welfare of our country and whether it can survive under the current standards that are being set.
We had talked about the anxiety around the way the immigration control enforcement is currently operating. And the era in which you grew up, you have friends who experienced similar anxiety. Can you tell me a bit about what Kumiko told you about her life experience?
Well, Sumiko is a friend of many years, and she and her husband met following the Second World War, and then he convinced her to come to America, and they were married and raised a family here. Sumiko had a difficult time. People didn't always accept her, and the things that she went through are just so difficult. Being in Japan during the nuclear war, the bombs that were dropped, and very difficult time. She had a younger brother who starved to death as a young child, because there just wasn't food. So what is happening with regard to immigrants, I think, is not just regrettable, it's I can't think of a word for it. It's so bad, so bad. And our country's built on immigrants. And these people come here and they make a life for themselves. And to be as bigoted as our government is or as our leaders are, to me is regrettable. It's just terrible. And as far as religion goes, freedom of religion is what our country's based on. And people who come here of another faith are welcome. Our country's leaders came here from another faith so they could practice their faith. And now we've got a president who says he's so against Muslims, he's against Mormons, he's against anybody that isn't according to him, doesn't agree with him. And agreeing with him is agreeing with a set of standards that nobody should be agreeing to. Now, as far as this ICE, as far as separating children from their parents, that's just downright wrong. You cannot justify that in any way. And they're not even doing it intelligently to where they know which parents are with which children and where. That, to me, is, again, it beyond regrettable.
Having lived in different countries, you've experienced different forms of press, of media. How do you think those countries compare to what we currently experience?
I didn't have much exposure to the press, but I think freedom of the press is essential to our country. And you can deride it and say it's fake news, but I think that just means it's news that I don't like. I lived for a year and a half in Santiago, Chile, and for a year and a half in Switzerland, near Bern. I didn't have much access to the news media. I did have access to the opportunities for advancement, that is, both cultural and the monetary advancement in jobs and so forth. And people felt very much more excluded than they do here in this country. And certainly we have more freedoms, we have more opportunities here than they had. And an awful lot of them wanted to come to America. Some of them not. Some of them were very loyal to their country. Switzerland had at that time, this was in the early 1980s, an interesting way of controlling the amount of work available. They would grant work visas to people from other countries until the unemployment rate went above what they wanted, and then they canceled the work visas. And all the foreigners had to go home so that the Swiss people would have opportunities for the jobs, which is kind of interesting. In Chile, that was when Pinochet was in power and the communists were trying to take over the country. And there was a lot of uproar. Times when they'd blow up the power lines and we'd lose electricity, kept candles nearby, and there were demonstrations, which were riots. We traveled to Israel a number of years ago. They thought that Americans were really not very intelligent because we didn't know several languages. And they had a joke about who can only speak one way, and that's Americans. But we're a big country. When you're smaller, you have to learn other languages to get along. But we don't. I mean, we can go our whole lives and never need to know anything but English. And so I'm just afraid that other countries view us as pampered and spoiled and not appreciating what we have. And they may be right.
How do you feel the Republican Party can embrace people such as yourself who don't support the current president but still identify as conservative, identify as Republican Party? How do you think they can still include you in the way going forward?
They can go back to the values they represent. Right now, it seems to me that what they want is to keep their jobs, and they will support the president so that they can get the votes. But I'm thinking and hoping that at the midterm elections coming up later this year, that will change the balance of power in the legislature, which will help a very great deal. If there were some way I could campaign for people, but our Washington state senators are already opposing President Trump. Our Washington state representative, House, the representative from our area, is not, and I will campaign against her. And this is too bad because I was so much in support of this person who is a young woman with a young family that she's had while in office, but she's supporting everything President Trump wants, and I don't think what he wants is good for the country. And so I will vote against her, and I hope she's defeated. But I think this is what every American citizen has to do, is decide from the local level onward who is going to represent what they want and change the legislature. And until that's done, I don't think the course the country has taken is going to change. And we've got people in Congress who have been there most of their lives and they want to stay there. So I think we have to change that component and hope that it can be done. There are a certain number of angry Americans, I'm sure, and they think that President Trump is representing them. But I can't imagine they're representing, that they think he's representing the things that he's doing.
What sort of candidate would you hope for in the next presidential election that you would hope the Republican Party nominates?
First of all, someone who has his own values, who has a long time marriage, who has children, who has family values. And I think that's the biggest thing we need. I hope it's somebody, as I said, who has good family values. Religion, whatever his religion is, that he has religious values as well. In other words, the morality of our current president is non-morality. I would hope that we can avoid that in the next president. Someone who would value our allies and, while representing business, also be smart about doing that. These tariffs that he's setting will hurt American business, and I don't see any sense in them. And his attitude toward Canada, I just can't understand. Canada has been a long-time neighbor and ally, and people come back and forth across the border, and we have Americans living in Canada and Canadians living in America, and have the same backgrounds and values that we do. And putting tariffs and excluding Canada, to me, it's absolutely senseless. And as far as Mexico is considered, instead of building an expensive wall that's going to hurt us ecologically, help the government and help them to where they don't need to come here to live. Help them with their economy to where they can stay home. These people love their country. They love Mexico, but they want to be able to sustain their families. So help the situation in Mexico to where they can. To me, that's this more sensible idea than spending millions and millions of dollars on a stupid wall. I know that's pretty strong, but it is a stupid wall. And I've had ecologists, heard them say that, you know, some of our animals breed back and forth. You put a fence there, how can they, you know, these are their breeding grounds. These are their feeding grounds. It just is not going to be a good thing for anybody.
How do you feel about those that are coming through Mexico that aren't Mexican, that are coming from Central America, which I know you've spent some time in Central America, so you're aware of some of the political tensions and issues there where some people are coming up through Mexico into the U.S.?
Well, if they're refugees, just as the same as you'd have refugees from any other country. I think they need to be cared for and welcomed, certainly vetted to see that we don't have gangsters coming in, but I don't think that that's the case in 99.9% of the time. These are people who are fleeing a bad situation, looking for a home where they can raise their families. And I see no reason whatsoever that we can't take and let them come in and let them contribute to our land, our economy. So it makes no difference to me if they're from Mexico or from Central America. They're still people who need help. And if we can help them, and I'm sure we can, it's better for everybody. They'll contribute to our society as well as ours contributing to their welfare.
You had mentioned self-reliance being an important value. How do you balance wanting to help other people from other countries with needing to encourage self-reliance?
Well, actually, they're exhibiting self-reliance coming to this country, to where they're trying to help themselves. And I think coming in, they can be, I think most of them will come in and work at whatever they can get and will probably be better with using their money than a lot of Americans are. They're going to be saving. They're going to be sending their kids to college. These people coming in from any country, education is prime for them, and they'll be contributing to the economy. Now, as far as self-reliance goes, I can't see that they're not being self-reliant. They're not asking for handouts. They're asking for opportunity. And I think we can give them that.
The She-Ra Solution is a monthly biography of women, past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. On this segment, Kristen talks about suffragists, including the woman whose work led to the world's first equal voting rights.
Born in 1847, Millicent Garrett, who would become Dame Millicent Garrett Fawcett, was quite familiar with gender inequality in England. One couldn't be a woman in most of the world at that time and not be aware. Fortunately for her, and us, she was surrounded by progressives from her birth, and she seemed to never doubt that she should fight for women's rights. Millicent's father was Newson Garrett. He worked as a ship owner, but demonstrating his radical politics was just as important to him as any full-time career. He had 10 children, Millicent being the seventh, and he supported the girls in their desired professions as much as he did the boys. Millicent's husband, Henry Fawcett, whom she married when she was not quite 20, was also a radical. He taught political economy at University of Cambridge. 2 years after her wedding to the Cambridge professor, Millicent started planning a women's college as part of Cambridge. Newnham College was established in 1871. It was one of the first women's colleges, and therefore one of the first colleges, period, that women could attend. At age 50, Millicent became president of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. For more than two decades, she and her colleagues worked to change England's laws to allow women to vote. In 1918, the Representation of the People Act allowed women over the age of 30 and who met a property requirement to vote. On the plus side, that meant the voices of 8.5 million women suddenly counted. On the negative, one-third of British women were still considered unqualified. The Act also abolished all qualifications, including owning property, for men. Suddenly, nearly all men over 21 could vote. Those in the military had to be only 19. A year later, in her 70s, Millicent retired from the Union. But the battle for voting rights, of course, went on. And 9 years later, all women were allowed to vote. The Equal Franchise Act of 1928 said all women over age 21 could speak and be counted. This act increased the number of women eligible to vote to 15 million. Millicent would die at age 82 the following year. Interestingly, one of England's own colonies beat the motherland to allowing women to vote by more than three decades. New Zealand was the first country in the world to legalize voting by women in 1893. There, Kate Sheppard, born Kate Malcolm, led the suffrage movement. She was born the exact same year as Millicent Garrett Fawcett, 1847, and also in England. But Kate moved to Christchurch, New Zealand as a young adult. She married Walter Sheppard, a merchant who apparently didn't mind, or couldn't prevent anyhow, his wife from not spending all her time doting on him, as was the mainstream expectation of women then. No, against great opposition from so many people around, Kate was involved in the New Zealand suffrage movement from 1885 on. She is known to have said, quote, "We are tired of having a sphere doled out to us and of being told that anything outside that sphere is unwomanly." Kate instead grew her own space, and it was massive. She not only wrote letters to the editor, but lobbied members of parliament, and she organized public meetings around the country. Imagine the scene when Kate and her fellow suffragists unrolled their petition to vote before parliament in 1893. The piece of paper was 885 feet long and contained the signatures of 32,000 women. I imagine them sending it unfurling, bouncing, cracking across the House floor. Kate didn't stop her work with the passage of the groundbreaking Electoral Act of 1893. Among other things, she became editor of The White Ribbon, the first New Zealand newspaper to be owned, managed, and published entirely by women. Kate outlived two husbands, her only child and her only grandchild. She seemed to have been holding on to life long enough to see the long-range effects of her work. In 1933, a woman became a member of parliament for the first time. In 1934, Kate died. Though memory of her certainly hasn't. Since 2014, a glowing green outline of Kate tells pedestrians at eight different intersections near Parliament in Wellington when to walk. Her image has replaced the traditional green man at those lights. In 2015, the Keep Kate campaign urged the city to make the unique lights permanent. Interestingly, as an aside, Since the Kate lights became permanent, Wellington has expanded on its idea, which is popular with residents and tourists alike, with two more new pedestrian crossings, including one that now glows in the shape of Carmen Roop, entertainer, businesswoman, and activist. She has been considered a role model for many, including Georgina Beyer, the world's first openly transsexual mayor. Maybe Carmen will be the topic of a future She-Ra solution. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
Contributor Denise Kovalchuk is the creator of The Politics of Living. This month, she presents an audio montage of the March 25, 2003 protests against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Thousands of people in Portland, Oregon blocked highways, bridges, and intersections.
Let's go back up to Dan Christopher and Jet Ranger 2 live there. Dan's been over the scene for several hours watching these protesters walk through the streets. And Dan, what's the latest from where you are?
Well, to be a little accurate here, it's been 9 hours, but who's counting it? So that's the latest from Jet Ranger 2. Steve Adley.
Much has been happening down at 2nd and Burnside. If you've been following the situation at all, we want to go back down there now.
Amy Clark, you're there. What's going on?
Officers are surrounding the group as I speak. A lot of these people seem as though they're pretty cold.
We saw a car go through. People are still sitting in the street.
If I sit down right now, I can get clubbed. I can get gassed.
And this woman just wanted to dance. As the evening wore on, the protests turned into a nightmare for commuters and police as protesters dispersed in all directions, leaving police unable to keep control of the roads.
Keep control.
Police fought back with what's believed to be pepper spray and billy clubs.
I mean, the police, when they're coming down the street flailing batons, we get hit with that.
After talking tactics, police arrested protesters blocking I-5 traffic underneath the Burnside Bridge. In other parts of town, police had to break out pepper spray. And on the steel bridge, protesters couldn't move beyond this barrier. They pushed and yanked at our camera, and then some even yelled and screamed.
You're crazy, man. You're not welcome here anymore. Your days are done with us.
A lot of them are with our looky-loos and looky-loos.
So we decided to find people who could actually articulate their point.
Okay, I want to go back down to 2nd and Burnside.
We've never seen a protest quite like this one, so spread out throughout the city.
Less than 20 minutes later, the crowd moved east over the Burnside Bridge. The crowd moved north on MLK.
The march north was not without tension.
As they moved north again, the chants of peace came with the scrawled graffiti and blended with violent intent.
Sir, what are you gonna do with those rocks? Sir, what are you gonna do with those rocks? Sir, what are you gonna do with those rocks?
Then McDonald's became the target.
Traces of chemical attack were detected.
Some rip down flags at the Shell station. Others tear down American flags at the Ford dealership.
And this woman just wanted to dance.
And apparently you'll have amnesty if you do that. And so far there do not seem to be many takers.
Mayor Katz at City Hall keeps her two-way radio.
This masked man was willing to talk with me.
A self-proclaimed war monger. It says so right on his shirt.
Steve Allen.
Calls himself Captain America.
Steve Allen.
Appearances can be deceiving.
Steve Allen.
He looked like he should be one of them.
Steve Allen. Steve Allen.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. Dan Tilken, we need to check in with you again and ask you if it's been the same status quo down there as far as every 10 to 15 minutes more protesters being walked away and arrested.
I cannot give you our location. The main thing, though, is we got through. We breached the line. We're through. the concertina wire and got through rather quickly. It did not get any opposition until just about 15 minutes ago. We're still moving forward here. I'll probably cut out as we accelerate. I may have to get under cover here for a bit. We're maybe engaging a couple of tanks here.
Last month, contributor ML Laurie joined the Politics of Living with her segment, Let's Stop for a Minute. Her reflections are focused on helping everyone to stop and think about our world, our thinking, and happiness. Here's the latest installment of Let's Stop for a Minute.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. In my last reflection, I talked about the idea that other than our unique biological makeup, we are only different because of our software programs, which are actually learned ways of thinking that we are taught as we grow up and experience the world. I left you with two questions. Is it possible that some of your software programs, your learned ways of thinking, are faulty, mistaken, or just wrong? And which of your learned software programs help you feel happy and which cause you to feel unhappy? So if some of our software programs are faulty and some cause us to be unhappy, is it possible to change our software programs? If our software programs on our hard drive are taught to us, learned, especially when we were children, is it possible to unlearn them? Think about this. Are white people in America the same as the whites in South Africa, Russia, or any other white culture or country? Are blacks in America the same as those in Africa, the black Aborigines in Australia, or in any other black culture or country? Are Jewish people in America the same as those in Israel, Europe, or any other Jewish country or culture? If we have a software program that says all whites, blacks, Jews, Muslim, or any group of people are all the same, is this a valid program? No, it is not a valid program. It is not valid because we are taught as a child what to think about ourselves and the world based on what country and culture we are born into. This type of software program can easily be seen as not valid if one logically examines the whole idea of being able to lump a whole group of people together as being the same, especially if they come from different countries. A software program that says all people of a particular religion or race are all the same can only be valid if we have met every person who belongs to the group and thereby able to make a judgment based on having met them all. This is just not possible in reality. So think about this. Is a child or any human being to be faulted for what religion they were taught by their parents or for what race they were born into? So is it really possible to change how we think about ourselves, our fellow humans, and the world? Are any of us really so different from any other human being? Please, stop for a minute and think about all of this. If it is possible to change or unlearn a faulty way of thinking that causes us to feel unhappy, how can that be done? Can we learn to be kind to ourselves and others when it comes to examining the software programs we were unknowingly taught when we were children? Again, think about which of your learned software programs about others in the world cause you to feel happy and which ones cause you to feel unhappy. Do you feel happy when you feel anger, hatred, frustration, intolerance, or just impatient or judgmental? Stop for a minute. Think about it. Can we just let go of the learned software programs that cause us to feel unhappy? Bottom line, the big question is, do you want to be happy? Stop for a minute. Think about it. I'm ML Laurie.
Well, that is all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Rochelle Schmid, ML Laurie, and The Politics of Living creator, Denise Kowalczyk. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Vicki Mazzone. Have a great day.